Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Boy, it's been a busy week for the bully pulpit. Healthcare yesterday, the economy, and minimum wage today. We'll talk about that for a while. Also on the program, orange juice and aluminum, but not together. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 4th of December. Good, as always, to have you with us, gang. President Obama gave an economic speech today, one of those big picture things he likes to do. Talked about health care and economic status and income inequality and, for a good chunk of time, the minimum wage and how people who are working in minimum wage jobs just keep getting farther behind. His speech came at a very opportune time for workers in one well-known low-wage industry, fast food. Continuing a series of strikes they have been organizing this year, they've got plans to walk off the job tomorrow in more than 100 different cities, calling for an increase in the federal minimum wage, which is $7.25 at the moment. Nancy Kane is a historian of American business at Harvard University, and we have her on from time to time. Hey, Nancy, how are you?
I'm well, Kai.
So these strikes that are coming on Thursday in the fast food industry, spreading out to bigger cities, more cities, I guess, do you think they're going to work? Are they going to be successful to get these workers higher wages?
I don't think the strikes are a big, huge factor in, you know, the possibility of raising wages. The strikes are going to be many. Some of them will be large in pockets. Some of them will not be. But I don't think right now the most important wave behind raising wages is worker strikes. I think it's much more of a large-scale appeal, and we see this in different states, and we see it in from President Obama, and we see it in broad spread public support for raising the minimum wage. I think that's the most likely kind of, if you will, you know, crest of energy that's likely to change workers' pay in these kind of industries.
If there has been, and there is actually wide support among both Democrats and Republicans for raising the minimum wage, how come it's stuck? Hasn't gone up in 4 years since 2009. It's $7.25 an hour, and that's, you know, that's not a whole lot of money.
It's not a whole lot of money. It's not weight. It's not price indexed, right? So in some sense, even with a modicum of inflation, you know, minimum wage workers are losing every year a little bit. You know, I think it's stuck because we're living in the age of a constipated government at the national level. I think there probably is some energy for that. Whether, you know, that happens in the post-debt ceiling moment in the new year is a very interesting and I think, again, potentially fertile question.
How much does it matter that the low-wage workforce, the people really about whom we're talking at these minimum wage jobs, used to be teenagers, right? Used to be 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds. Now it's an older workforce. They are the breadwinners in the family, men and women. Does that matter in this debate?
I think it matters a lot, right? Yeah. Something like 43% of low-wage workers have some college experience. So that's a big deal. But I think there's something else that's really a big deal that really underlies this bipartisan support. And that is, you know, it goes back to Bruce Springsteen, right? And Darkness on the Edge of Town, you know, and all those songs like The Factory that he sings. Yeah. Americans understand and respect the working life. You know, a day's work should be paid at a living wage. And, you know, we kvetch about all kinds of things. We disagree about, you know, the finer points of health care, you know, food stamps, the social safety net, executive compensation. We don't disagree about someone showing up for work, doing a job, and being paid a decent wage.
Nancy Kane at the Business School at Harvard University. Nancy, thanks a bunch.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street today, traders just could not make up their minds, up, down, and all the way around. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We bring you now two words you might have thought you'd heard the last of, yet which somehow keep on popping up, subprime loans. They are, as the saying goes, back. A report out today from Experian, the credit bureau, says borrowers are getting car loans that are bigger and for longer terms and increasingly subprime. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports on history repeating itself.
Back before the recession, about a quarter of the loans for new cars were considered subprime.
And now it's about 27, 28%. So it's not only recovered, it's passed its pre-recession levels.
Lacey Plocky is chief economist at Edmunds.com. She understands why people might hear about an increase in subprime loans and fear that history is repeating itself.
That's what it looks like at first glance, is that, oh man, we didn't learn our lessons, we're right back in the soup. But I think really it's certainly too soon to have that fear.
She believes the standards for auto loans had gotten too tight. And that's left many consumers sidelined because they couldn't get a car loan. Borrowers who might have some dings on their credit, but otherwise have jobs and represent a good credit risk.
These people are now getting access to the market again.
These consumers aren't as risky as you might expect. Research shows most folks will pay the car loan before other bills. If worse comes to worst, they can always sleep in the car. But what about the housing market? Could the trend in auto loans point to more subprime loans for homes?
It's non-existent in the mortgage market today. It has not come back at all.
Sam Cater analyzes real estate trends for CoreLogic. In terms of subprime housing loans, he says,
10 years ago, they were at about 10%, and then they peaked at about 15%. Today, they're under one-half of 1% and not increasing.
He expects another bubble someday, but he says it's very unlikely to come in the form of another subprime meltdown. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Because we told you about that, subprime meltdowns, that is, we are now going to tell you about this. Next week is going to be a very big week in the world of financial regulation. The Volcker Rule, a key part of the Dodd-Frank reform bill, is going to be up for a couple of key votes. When it was drafted 3-something years ago, the Volcker Rule was supposed to stop big banks from making speculative bets with depositors' money, money that is insured by the FDIC, so that if those bets were to go bad, taxpayers wouldn't be on the hook. Marketplace's David Weinberg reports on whether that is still the case.
When the Volcker Rule was first introduced, the big banks immediately began attacking it, says former bank regulator Bill Black.
And for a considerable time period, all the rumors were that they were having great success, that they were getting a very weak version of the Volcker Rule.
But then along came a disaster. The London Whale, which resulted in over $2 billion in losses. And the loss from J.P. Morgan's London Whale bet
was greater than all of their supposed gains. In other words, everything Paul Volcker warned about turned out to be true.
Regulators then came up with a tougher version of the Volcker Rule, one with fewer loopholes that would allow banks to make trades for themselves. But under the rule, banks could continue making those trades, called proprietary trades, but just call them hedges, says financial advisor Anisha Saker.
When you're dealing with complex financial products and these very arcane rules, it's easy to spin, a trade or a hedge one way or another to suit your own purposes.
So the Volcker Rule set out to define every type of trade in order to prevent these sorts of evasions from the law, which would make it even tougher.
Here's the dark side of all of this. If you try to cover in your rule every means of potential evasion of something you're calling a hedge that isn't really a hedge, you end up with what the rumors say is about to come out, which is a well over 800-page rule.
Regulators will make their final decision on the rule on December 10th. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
Coffee to start one's day, of course, at least for yours truly. Tea, perhaps, for some of you. Orange juice, maybe for others. 90%, plus or minus, of the OJ that we drink in this country comes from oranges grown in Florida, where the harvest is in full swing. But the crop down there has been hammered the past couple of years by a bacteria that has killed hundreds of thousands of orange trees. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith took a little road trip to check it out.
Orange farmer Mark Wheeler is scouting for disease. We're in his grove of Valencia orange trees near the town of Dundee in central Florida. A small red tractor with a giant fan attached to it is grinding its way along the white sand rows between the trees. It's spraying nutrients onto the leaves,
which kind of helps bring the tree around, gives it a little shot in the arm, basically.
Like a multivitamin.
Exactly.
Wheeler is using this spray to help fight a disease called greening. It's a bacteria that's moved from tree to tree by a small mosquito-like bug. It grows inside the tree and blocks its arteries, and the tree starts having trouble moving nutrients from leaf to root. Eventually, it starves to death.
I mean, it is just taking areas out completely, killing the trees.
Wheeler spots an infected tree. It has shriveled, yellowing leaves that are the hallmark of the disease, as well as small, misshapen fruit that falls easily off the tree.
We are losing trees, losing crop, losing yield.
Matthew Saloy is an economist at the Florida Department of Citrus. He says since greening was discovered in the state about 8 years ago, orange production has been cut in half. And because of treatments like the nutritional spray, the cost of producing those oranges has doubled.
In an effort to combat greening and care for the tree to maintain its health for as long as possible, growers are taking on added costs.
And that's been hard on the companies that buy those oranges and squeeze them into juice. At Peace River Citrus Products in Bartow, Florida, oranges are trucked in from all over the state. They're taken up a giant elevator, cleaned, sliced, and squeezed into millions of gallons of juice every day. Peace River produces orange juice for Coca-Cola's Simply and Minute Maid brands, among others. Andrew Taylor is the CFO.
When I got into the business back in the late 1980s, there were 30 companies in the citrus processing side of the business. Today, there are seven.
Taylor says greening means farmers have less fruit to sell him, and the fruit they do have is often smaller, less sweet, and more expensive.
Those changes can wipe out your margins unless you're in a position where you're managing that price risk.
One way Peace River is managing that risk is with the futures market. Processors can buy contracts to deliver orange juice months in advance to help them lock in a price and hopefully a profit. But the greening disease is affecting that market too. James Cordier is a commodities trader. He's been buying and selling orange juice contracts for more than 20 years.
Trading right now in orange juice is the smallest I've seen it. You know, it's down to trading sometimes 1,000 or 1,500 contracts a day, half of what it was just a few years ago.
Cordier says the market usually rallies when there's a freak storm or a freeze because processors are motivated to lock in prices for the next season. But as Florida's orange production has steadily declined, so have the number of orange juice contracts. At the same time, the dwindling crop yields have pushed up the price of the juice we buy at the store.
But what's happened in orange juice consumption over the last 2 years, it's just fallen off dramatically. Orange juice is one of the most expensive items a purchaser can bring out of the grocery store.
But we still love our juice. Americans consume more than 500 million gallons of OJ every year, and companies want to make sure they'll have the oranges to meet that demand. So some are starting to grow their own. Coca-Cola is teaming up with Peace River to plant 25,000 new acres of orange groves. That should help it control costs and production at a time when many orange farmers are going under.
We've got about 180 acres of young trees here.
Farmer Mark Wheeler says he's not worried about Coke becoming a competitor. At his grove in Dundee, Florida, Wheeler shows off thousands of new plantings. But as we're looking over the rows of chest-high orange trees, Wheeler spots signs of greening.
And just how light the leaves are on this branch, really, the greening on it really comes into display here. And you can see it on the one over there as well. A lot of fruit on the ground already.
Wheeler says greening has changed the economics of the entire orange juice business. His family has even been forced to sell some of their groves. He says his family will never stop growing oranges, but they have diversified. They're farming trees for lumber, and they've just started growing peaches. In Dundee, Florida, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, once you've extracted it, it's almost infinitely recyclable.
Aluminum or aluminium. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, it's a sad music, but not by a whole lot. It was a toss-up, really. The Dow Industrials took off a 10%, 24 points, closed at 15,889. The NASDAQ traded almost flat, closed at 4,038. The S&P 500 dropped about a 10%, 2 points, ended at 1792. Financials actually mostly bucked the trend. Bank of America tipped up nearly 2/3%. Today, J.P. Morgan Chase picked up more than 0.5%, as did Morgan Stanley. Citigroup was the sole loser, slipped about 0.1% today. On the home front, sales of new homes recorded their biggest monthly increase in years, but builders were mixed. KB Homes nailed a 1% gain, but Lennar got nailed with a 2% loss. Pulte gave back nearly a half percent today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.83%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for October. Grocery retailer Kroger releases quarterly earnings. And it's the 80th anniversary of the 21st Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. If you don't know what that is, have a cocktail with dinner. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Newsweek is coming back from the dead. It's bringing back a print version a year or so, maybe less, after going all digital. The magazine's new owner, a company called IBT Media, seems to think old school paper and ink can rise again starting in the first quarter of next year. So, nuts or not nuts? Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
Sure sounds nuts, especially when print magazines are beginning to feel almost antiquated and sales of news magazines at newsstands dropped 16% on average last year after years of losing readers, not to mention advertisers. Newsweek editor-in-chief and self-described crusty magazine veteran Jim Impoco.
Most people are assuming that I talked my 31-year-old owners into to getting back into print, but it's the opposite.
Impoco says his boss has convinced him there is an audience for a printed Newsweek, people willing to read long-form journalism. And this Newsweek will be paid for mostly with subscriptions, not ad revenue. A boutique product, Impoco says, meaning smaller readership, bigger price tag.
More emphasis on reporting, deep reporting, and creating our own weather, you know, making news.
But first, Newsweek has to remake an 80-year-old brand. Tom Rosensteel, a former Newsweek reporter who now heads the American Press Institute, says that's going to be tough.
You're creating a new product, a new identity in a marketplace that is even more crowded than it was.
And Newsweek is betting that all that noise may have some of us yearning for more reflective journalism. The Pew Center's Amy Mitchell says people are already reading longer articles on their tablets.
So there's a question of whether people are willing to bring that back to the print side.
One magazine analyst told me he believes physical magazines still have their uses. They can drive people to the digital side. After all, he noted, your dentist can't leave a Newsweek app lying around the waiting room. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Among the many other traditions this time of year brings with it is a distinct rise in the number of requests that we all get for charitable contributions. Makes sense, 'tis the season and all that. And a lot of groups use in-house staff to raise their money. Some charities, though, rely on for-profit telemarketing and direct mail companies to get it done. That in and of itself is a billion-dollar industry in which not everybody is upfront about who they are and where the donations are going to go. Kendall Taggart has our story.
Back in April 2010, a secretary in Des Moines named Kathy Smith got a call from a man who said he was from the Vietnam Veterans of Iowa.
We just want to thank you for always helping the local VAs and our local veterans here in Des Moines. And the vets wanted me to salute you and say God bless if I could. You know, they really did love you for it, ma'am.
The man explained he was raising money as part of an annual campaign to help military veterans in Des Moines. But the caller wasn't from a veterans group, and the call wasn't placed in Iowa. It came from an office in Michigan run by Associated Community Services. ACS is one of the country's largest for-profit fundraising companies. The group raised $40 million in 2011 from thousands of small donors nationwide.
Where are you located then?
Well, actually, our headquarters for the charity is here in your home city.
But there was deception on both sides. The woman on the other end runs an undercover phone line for the Iowa Attorney General's office. State investigators use calls like this one to determine that telemarketers lied to potential donors. So far, they've banned more than a dozen telemarketing companies from operating in Iowa, including ACS. Steve St. Clair heads the state's Consumer Protection Division.
The primary recipients are older Iowans,
And so you're talking people of retirement age.
His office found that the company's most prolific donors were 69 or older. Other states are now paying attention to how Iowa has cracked down on deceptive fundraising. But those states don't want to be identified because they might tip off potential targets.
I don't miss doing it at all anymore. I don't miss because you got to have a soul and a conscience. When you work there, you can't have one.
John Abraham worked at ACS for 4 years alongside hundreds of telemarketers. Abraham and other former ACS employees told us first-time donors became targets for dozens of future calls. Some donors were called twice a day for two different charity clients, in the morning for breast cancer and in the evening for veterans.
Like, you tell them, we're only doing this campaign once a year. You'll call them back in a month.
I think I felt sorry for them, thinking it was such a terrible job that they had to call people all the time.
Earlene Williams is a 74-year-old retired child care provider who unintentionally ended up on ACS's hot list. She donated 21 times to 9 different charities represented by the company.
I think I had a hard time saying no.
Very little of the money Williams donated actually went to charity. That's because ACS keeps between 80 and 85 cents of every dollar donated, according to contracts filed with state regulators. For now, Iowans shouldn't be receiving any calls from ACS while the ban is in place. But the company is appealing the ruling. ACS declined interview requests but said it had not misled donors.
I do like to give, but I expect honesty, and I'm finding that it's not the case in lots of these situations.
Williams says she now carefully screens her calls and only gives directly to groups she's familiar with. In Des Moines, Iowa, I'm Kendall Taggart for Marketplace.
Kendall's story was produced for us by the Center for Investigative Reporting and the Tampa Bay Times. You can take a peek at their list of America's worst charities on our website. It's marketplace.org. When you think of all the ways you can look at the global economy, look in a literal sense, a microscope is probably not the first thing you think of. But honestly, you'd be surprised at what you learn when you take a very, very close look at the stuff that makes up all the stuff that we buy. Justin Rowlett from the BBC is doing just that with a series on the chemical elements that rule our economy. Justin, good to have you back.
Very good to be here, Kai.
Last time we spoke, I believe we were having pronunciation lessons, yes? Aluminium versus aluminium?
That's right. I was teaching you how to say aluminium.
So to the point, you've been out exploring a bit with this metallic substance. First of all—
Now, I don't—
Go ahead. What?
Well, I was going to say I don't want to admit to bias, but I did think aluminium was quite boring.
Really?
Well, it's kind of gray and dull. It's kind of, you know, it's stable. I mean, you know, What's so interesting about aluminium? Of course, it's useful. You know, you make windows and stuff out of it, drinks cans, but didn't seem very alluring. But actually, I think aluminium is a lot more interesting than I thought.
All right, now you have to get me interested because it's everywhere, right? I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah, aluminium is incredibly useful. It's light, it's versatile, it's tough. And we think of it as something that's inert. But actually, aluminium is a very reactive metal. And the reason it isn't shiny is because it reacts with the air and creates a rust, an oxidized layer on top, which is incredibly hard. One of the hardest substances there is.
And at the same time, it's flexible and pliable, and you can crumple up aluminum foil and tin cans can crumple easily. I mean, it's in a way, it's a little bit of a miracle.
It is a miracle. And here's another thing. This metal, which is very, very hard to get hold of, takes a huge amount of energy to extract from the bauxite. Once you've extracted it, it's almost infinitely recyclable. And very plausibly, quite soon, we'll be recycling 85% of the aluminium that's produced, which means we will probably have mined enough aluminium for the rest of humanity's existence.
Wow.
We will never need to dig it up again. It's one of the few things you can say, well, actually, one day we may have enough of, we may not need to dig for it anymore.
That's extraordinary. My guess, however, would be that we'd keep on digging just because that's the way we are.
Well, it depends. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, how much do you need? I mean, at the moment, there's a huge spike in demand for aluminium, and that's because people around the world are suddenly getting enough money to buy fizzy drinks in aluminium cans, to buy cars which are increasingly being made of aluminium. We spoke to a company that is the biggest seller of rolled aluminium sheeting. That sounds like a very boring thing. It's actually the most commonly used form of aluminium. It's the stuff that you make your drinks cans out of, and it's also what you make cars out of. The recycling time for aluminium drinks cans is now about 60 days. So that's how quickly it goes from being, you know, a drinks can into being another drinks can, if you like. So it happens quite quickly. So I think it is plausible, Kai.
One more thing on aluminum before I let you go. When you guys spell it, do you actually put the extra I in there at the end?
Well, there are two I's in aluminium. How many are there in
One here.
In aluminum?
Just one.
Really? No, there's two. Yeah. You know, there's another correction for you. Right. We're learning a lot here, aren't we, Kai?
Next time, we'll chat about something else. All right, Justin Rowlett from the BBC. We'll see you.
We certainly will. Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today. You think we go nuts over holiday spending here? You ain't seen nothing yet. From Quartz, the Atlantic's business website, these figures. In Australia, shoppers spend 35% more in December than they do in other months. Italians, 32% more. The Brits, 30% more. Us, a mere 18% more in December than in other months. So, hey, go crazy out there, all right? Live a little. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM on this Wednesday. Today, the Dow took off about a 10%, 24 points. The NASDAQ was flat, ended right where it started. The S&P 500 dropped to 10%. That is 2 points. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. See you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.